all the evidence points to it. So even naturalists believe that events that happen only once and are never repeated can have more evidence for them. Secondly, all naturalistic scientists believe that life started by spontaneous generation. They have to, why? Because they believe once there was just chemicals, and then you got life. Where did life come from? Well, you know, chemicals self-form some way, you know, amino acids from basic gases and lightning coming through them, and all kinds of naturalistic scenarios, whether on Earth or in outer space and brought here, doesn't matter. Life had to start by spontaneous generation if you're a naturalist, because if there's a God, then he can create it. But if there is no God, you know, all you have is natural laws and chemicals, and then you get a living cell. How are you going to get that living cell? It has to happen naturally. But you ask him, how many times did it happen? Is it happening today? Is it happening over and over? Can you put, let's say, some dust in the water, and out of that dust in the water is going to come life? No, not unless there's bacteria already in there. If you sterilize the beaker, as Pasteur did, Pasteur's sterilized beaker is still there, no life in it. Ready and Pasteur proved spontaneous generation doesn't happen. But every naturalist scientist believes it did happen at least once, way back there, and it's never repeated. So there's a one-time event that they all believe the evidence is stronger for. How many times did evolution happen? Well, we're just assuming naturalism here. And they all believe in some form of evolution. How many times did we go from reptiles, from infantiles to reptiles to crocodiles to Gentiles? That's the theory of evolution. Once I was a tadpole when I did begin, then I was a frog with my tail tucked in, then I was a monkey swinging from a tree, and I'm a professor with a PhD. That's evolution. How many times did that happen? Once. It's not happened again. They all believe that. So here you have Big Bang, spontaneous generation, evolutionary process, all events they believe in that are not being repeated over and over, that so far as they know happened only once, and yet they believe they happened. All of those argue against Hume's argument. In fact, there's something radically wrong with Hume's argument. And all you have to do is think of it this way. Suppose a miracle did happen. Suppose Hume was standing there at the cross. He saw that Jesus died, was absolutely convinced he was dead, saw him put him in the grave, rolled a stone. 3 days later, he was standing there when Jesus came out, said, put your finger in my hand, your hand in my side. And he actually encountered the resurrected Christ. According to Hume, according to his view, he couldn't believe in what he himself was empirically experiencing, because his argument says that even if a miracle happens, you shouldn't believe it happened. Now, there's something wrong with the view when, if it happens, you shouldn't believe it. There's something wrong with the view, your view of golf, if you say, if a hole-in-one happens and a guy who's not good got it on the first shot, you shouldn't believe it. I mean, if he got it, he got it. If you saw it, you saw it. Something's wrong with your theory when your theory eliminates reality, when your theory is contrary to fact. And Hume's argument would work even if a miracle did happen, because it's not an argument against the factuality of a miracle. It's an argument against the credibility of a miracle. So you shouldn't believe it, even though it did happen. Hume's argument is wrong. Let me give you a fourth reason. C.S. Lewis gives this one. He said, how many times did the history of our planet occur? This is in his book, Miracles. Once. Is there anyone who doubts that the history of our planet occurred? We're not talking about what's in the history of it and how you interpret it. Everybody knows the history of our planet occurred, except some dumb philosopher who says it was all created in your mind 1 second ago and it didn't hear me. But other than that view, everybody believes that the history of our planet occurred, and it occurred just once. According to him, you shouldn't believe it, because anything that doesn't occur over and over and over again, you have no grounds for believing it. So much for Hume. Now, after I gave that argument to the Harvard chapel and invited them back to evangelicalism, nobody came. Why not? That's still the only argument, or an argument just like this, that is used against miracles to this day. Now, if the total argument for modern anti-supernaturalism is destroyed, why do people still believe in anti-supernaturalism? Because they have an incurable bias. They have an incurable bias against it. Higher criticism is built on this argument. Higher criticism falls to the ground with this argument. Second objection. Arguments against miracles used to support a religious system. Even if this argument were valid, it wouldn't disprove miracles, it would just disprove our apologetics. No miracle can be used to support a religious system if any contrary religious system has a miracle to support it. Contraries cannot be true, they cancel out each other. But all religious systems use miracles to support their claims. Therefore, no miracle can be used to support a religious system. Well, the argument, again, is valid, and the conclusion follows validly from it. So if the premises are true, the conclusion is true. And if the conclusion isn't true, then at least one premise must be false. And I would say that in his case, both premises are false. No miracle can be used to support a religious system if any contrary religious system has a miracle to support it. That's true in theory, but in practice it's not the case, because it's not the case that every religious system has supernatural events to support it. Confucius never even offered any miracles. Buddha never offered any miracles. For that matter, Muhammad never offered any miracles in the Quran. Those were invented 200 years later by Muslims to support the system, but he refused to do miracles in the Quran. When they asked him, they said, look, all the prophets before you did miracles. Why don't you do one if you're a prophet? He said, here, just read this. And he gave him a surah, a chapter out of the Quran. Well, that's not a miracle. So what we have here is a false premise in fact. In theory, of course, equal miracles for opposing views would be self-canceling, but in fact there are no such. B, all religious systems use miracles to support their claims. False, they don't. Only one religious system has truly supernatural events credibly reported from first-hand eyewitnesses, contemporaries of the events. Only one. And that's Christianity. Buddhism doesn't, Hinduism doesn't, Confucianism doesn't, Islam doesn't. The only major world religion that has it is Christianity. But let's suppose for the sake of argument that they did. Suppose that all systems had equal miracles. That would be self-canceling, and therefore you couldn't use miracles to prove your system. You'd have to have something else. You'd have to have some existential encounter, pragmatic test for truth, subjective test for truth, or you just have to believe it. That doesn't mean the miracles didn't happen. This is not an argument against miracles happening. This is simply an argument against the apologetic value of miracles if everybody had them, but they don't. B, objections to miracles in practice. Objection to miracles in practice in general. There never have, in fact, been a sufficient number of educated men to secure against delusion, nor with enough integrity to show no deception. The proven tendency of men against all probability to readily believe the miraculous and the many actual forgeries argue against miracles. Miracles abound chiefly among uneducated and uncultured. The advantages for starting an imposture are greater there than among the educated. Every miracle is in fact self-defeating, for in defending a system versus opposing a system, it thereby destroys the ability of any miracle to defend any system. Well, all we say is Hume is arguing here contrary to fact. We do have many credible witnesses to miracles. In fact, the resurrection, we have 500. 500 eyewitnesses over a 40-day period of time on 12 different occasions, who were themselves skeptical before they encountered Christ. That's as credible as you get for any event from the ancient world, so Hume's argument simply is wrong. In fact, you can take Hume's criteria for determining a truthful witness and apply it to the New Testament witnesses and find out that they were credible. Simon Greenleaf did it in this book, The Testimony of the Evangelist. Here's the number one attorney in America, Harvard attorney who taught legal evidence, who wrote the book on legal evidence. And his student said, why don't you apply these rules to see if the New Testament witnesses were telling the truth? He wrote a book called The Testimony of the Evangelist, in which he was converted to Christianity because by the same rules that you determine whether somebody's telling the truth in court, these witnesses were telling the truth, therefore the miracles occurred and Christianity is valid. So Hume is simply wrong at that point.
What was his name?
Simon Greenleaf, The Testimony of the Evangelist, reprinted by Baker. The fourth objection to Christian miracles in particular. The people were ignorant, that is, those believing and reporting the miracles. The record comes from a period long after the alleged events. There was no corroborative or concurring testimony, and they resemble the fabulous accounts every people have of their origins. Wrong on all four. Struck out. St. Luke was not ignorant. He was a very intelligent. St. Paul was not ignorant. Very intelligent person. And besides that, who says you have to have a formal education in order to be smart? I would imagine Matthew was pretty smart. He was a tax collector. He was a pretty sharp. Peter wasn't too dumb. He might not have been formally educated, but he was pretty sharp, as was John. We have many educated and many smart people among the witnesses. Furthermore, if you had to be educated to be a witness, how many people would be in jail today who committed crimes? You say, well, just the wash lady, so the janitor saw it. But we didn't have any PhDs on the faculty who saw the murder. Just the wash lady and the janitor did. I'd rather believe the wash lady and the janitor than a PhD anyway, you know. So that's not a very good criteria. B, the record comes from a period long after the events. False. Matthew was an eyewitness, Mark was an eyewitness, John was an eyewitness, and Luke interviewed all the eyewitnesses, was contemporary of the events. The record doesn't come from long after. C, there was no corroborative or concurring testimony. Well, how about 9 people wrote 27 books recording 500 people who saw it? Does that sound like corroborative testimony? In the mouth of 2 or 3 witnesses, every word should be established. D, they resemble the fabulous accounts of every people have of their origins. Not true. All you have to do is compare 2nd and 3rd century apocryphal gospels. Just get Charles' Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha and read them. With the 1st century gospel accounts, and you'll see the difference between a myth and a true narrative, a true literal reporting of the events. They're simple, they're straightforward, they're honest, they're fresh. These people lived and died for their testimony, very different than the apocryphal stories filled with Gnosticism, Docetism, fabulous tales, exaggerated reports of the 2nd and 3rd century. Now, if Hume's arguments are that easy to refute, then all of modern criticism is equally that easy to refute, and it all crumbles with it. But before we pronounce its benediction on modern anti-supernaturalism, let's take a look at Immanuel Kant. Life and Work, 1724 to 1804. Look at some of his works. General History of Nature, Critique of Pure Reason, Prolegomena, Any Future Metaphysics, Critique of Practical Reason, of Judgment, Religion Within the Limits of Reason Alone. His epistemology, or theory of knowledge, was very simple. It's under C. We cannot know the thing in itself, which he called the noumena. We can only know the thing to me, which he called the phenomena. Why is that? You can't get out of yourself. I don't know what the real world is in itself. I just know the way it appears to me. I don't know the way it really is. I know the way it seems to be. So there's a great gulf between the ultimate world, the real world, and what I know. And that gulf is unpassable. Kant's agnosticism. How do we know the gulf is there? Well, just try and apply your mind to the real world and you end up in antinomies, C3. Thesis, the world must have had a beginning, else a finite number of moments passed by now, rather an infinite, that should be an infinite, not an, else an infinite number of moments passed by now. Antithesis, the world could not begin in time, else there was time before time began. You can't have that. So you end up in contradiction. Or antinomy of causality, not every cause has a cause, else the series would never begin. And so first cause exists, but the series cannot have a beginning since everything has a cause. So you end up in contradictions. So what do? Give up thinking about reality, because reality is not knowable by your mind. Kant's two arguments for agnosticism that left the modern world locked out from God. Now with agnosticism about God philosophically in hand, then he went on to conclude a deistic God. God is deistic. He created the world, but no miracles. In fact, Kant was the originator of the nebular hypothesis, the first natural explanation of the origin of our solar system. And Kant argued against miracles, which we want to look at now under number four. Here's his argument. The basis for the argument against miracles, first is agnosticism, and second is scientific naturalism. Sir Isaac Newton, law of gravitation. Here's Kant's statement of the argument. We cannot know the real world, the world in itself, by our theoretical reason, by our mind. Everything in our experience, the world to us, must be determined by practical reason. But practical reason operates according to universal laws. But a miracle is an exception to universal law. Therefore, miracles do not occur. Further, if miracles occurred, they would have to occur regularly, seldom, or never. But what occurs regularly is not a miracle. It's a natural law. And what occurs seldom is not determined by any law. It's just a happenstance event. Therefore, it is rationally necessary to conclude that miracles never occur. That's his argument against miracles. Well, first of all, now we're backtracking because we're going back to Spinoza's view of natural law, that there are no exceptions, at least in practice, and he's begging the whole question. He's assuming that if something occurs in the natural world, it had to have a natural cause. Well, that would mean even if you could show something occurred, he would say, well, that doesn't come under any law, so we can't count it. We must think according to natural law. Well, that begs the question by saying, if it's not regular, it's not natural. Well, of course a miracle isn't regular and isn't natural. But so what? Just because things that happen regularly come under a natural law doesn't mean that things that don't happen regularly couldn't come under the supernatural category. Because a miracle is an irregular, rare event. A natural law is a regular, non-rare event. So you have every right, if it happens regularly, to classify it as a natural law, but if it doesn't happen regularly, you have no right to classify it as a natural event. Nor do you have the right to say to me, you must think of it in order to think rationally according to the regular event. Because then irregular events, like the beginning of the universe, the beginning of life, the beginning of the evolutionary process, the whole history of the universe, we're right back to the same arguments against Hume that apply to Kant as well. Immanuel Kant is easy to remember because he's the guy who said, you just can't know. And he said, you can't know because of the wrong reasons. His agnosticism is easy to refute because what did he say? His agnosticism says, I know that you can't know anything about reality. Well, if you know that you can't know anything about reality, then you do know something about reality, namely that you can't know anything else about reality. All right, let's stop there and talk about the anti-supernaturalism and how it affects miracles and biblical criticism. Any questions, comments? Yes.
There are people now who like to look at the miracles and give a naturalistic mechanism to them. Do you think they're making a mistake?
Yes, I do, with rare exceptions to that. I mean, of all the miracles in the Bible, there are only one or two that have any kind of naturalistic explanation to it, and even they are not really naturalistic explanations. I'm thinking of, for example, the Red Sea, where a strong wind mm-hmm. blew all night and blew back the waters. Well, first of all, a strong wind does not cause two walls of water to sand solidly each side. Strong wind doesn't explain why when they got through, the whole thing collapsed on Pharaoh and his army. I mean, even though a strong wind is mentioned there, and even though that may be part of what God used to perform, there was still a supernatural event to perform. Then other than that, you're hard-pressed to find things where you can find any kind of naturalistic mechanism by which God performed it. And even if you can, it still takes a supernatural cause to use that, because even that natural mechanism by itself would not have produced that event. So I think you're really barking up a wrong tree to find naturalistic explanations for supernatural events.
Well, I don't want to pick on anybody, but just as an example, Henry Morris, the creation science man, tends to do this. He describes how he thinks the flood happened and things like that. You also think that's barking up the wrong tree?
Well, I don't, in all fairness to Henry Morris, and I'm not one of Henry Morris's chief defenders by any means, because I don't accept his view, but in all fairness to him, I don't think he's doing that in that case, because all he's saying is, in fact, I think he's a naturalist. I don't think he's too. First of all, the Bible doesn't call the flood a supernatural event. So there's no reason why it can't have a purely natural. All he is saying is, let's look at the principles of science, and the principles of science, rightly interpreted, come out with a catastrophe view of interpreting the data rather than a uniformitarian view. So if the Bible said that was a miracle, and then he was coming up with a purely natural explanation of it, then I think he would be guilty of that charge. But I don't think the Bible calls it a miracle, and therefore finding a natural explanation is just saying, look, science has wrongly interpreted the geological data. It should be interpreted as happening quickly by catastrophic events, which you can see today. You know, what do? They do the study on Mount St. Helens. They see it doesn't take that long for life to grow again there. So they're using purely natural laws to come to a natural explanation of earthquakes, volcanoes, floods, etc., rather than saying that the old uniformitarian view is correct.
Well, would you elaborate a little bit more then on what you're meaning by a biblical miracle? Because I thought the flood was a pretty good example.
No, a biblical miracle, we wrote a whole book on this called Miracle in the Modern Mind, which we go into in great detail, so if you want to look at it more, I recommend you get that book. But a miracle has to have both a scientific space-time dimension and a theological higher aspect to it too. In other words, a miracle has two sides to it. On the earthly side, a miracle is at least an anomaly. It's at least a rare, irregular, unrepeated event. It has to be a singularity versus a regularity. It has to be something rare rather than something that happens over and over. But just because it's rare doesn't mean it's automatically a miracle, because there are anomalies, you know, like how does the bumblebee fly, or how does life live on thermal vents in the depths of the sea, which scientists don't know. It's too deep, too hot, but there is life there. So it needs more than that. It needs a theological context. To be a miracle, it has to have evidence of intelligence, of intelligent intervention from the outside. Just like creation, when we look at the origin of, let's say we look at a living cell, and we say that cell could not have evolved by natural processes because it shows signs of intelligent designs. You have to have all the pieces together at one time simultaneously, what's called irreducible complexity. I don't know if you've had a chance to read yet the book called Darwin's Black Box, but it's the best critique of evolution in maybe the last generation, and it just came out not too long ago. And I'm trying to think of the author's name, Heffe or something like that, H-E-F-E, I think. It's Darwin's Black Box. And he argues that the cell, Darwin called it a black box because they didn't understand the inner workings of a cell in Darwin's day, the cell has irreducible complexity that shows an intelligent being had to put it all together at one time or it wouldn't work. Because you break it down to component parts, it won't work. And they all have to be there at the same time. Now, we say that shows sign of intelligent invention. I say a miracle is the same thing. It happens to be rare, but it has to also show signs of intelligent intervention at that point. Here's a crude illustration. Suppose you were looking in your bowl of alphabet cereal, and you looked down in the bowl, and you saw S-O-S. Would you assume that there's a ship in distress somewhere? No, that's not the right context. But suppose you were on a ship in the middle of a storm and your radio is on and you hear in Morse code S-O-S. Do you assume there's a ship in distress? Yes, because that's a different context. That's a context in which you expect that that's coming from an intelligent being. Now, sometimes the same event in a different context can show signs of intelligent intervention. That's what we have to do to show it's a miracle, not just that it's rare, but that it has signs of intelligent intervention. Or to put it in biblical language, there are three words used for miracle in the Bible. What are they? Power, sign, and wonder. A miracle has three aspects. It has to have a supernatural cause, a power. It has to signify something. It has to have some kind of message to it. And it has to be a wonder, something that's unusual. It has to be rare. The wonder part is the scientific part. This is very unusual. I mean, here's a burning bush over here. That's not unusual. Bushes burn all the time in the desert. Ah, but this one doesn't stop burning. It's burning, it's not consumed. That's unusual. Then you go over and look at it, and it talks to you. That's unusual. So you got to have something, a wonder. Then it has to have a sign. In the Bible, miracles had, they were always connected with a sermon. Sermon, and the miracle was the sign for it. Message, miracle, sermon, sign, revelation, confirmation. So it has to have that dimension to it. The dimension of the intelligible message, the dimension of the intelligent intervention, and the dimension of unusual event combined make it a miracle. The flood doesn't do that. The flood is not a violation of any natural law. Where I think Henry Morse is inconsistent is here. He criticizes the principle of uniformitarianism, but he uses uniformitarianism to establish his view of catastrophe. Because he says, look today, floods today, he's a hydrologist, floods today can produce a lot of stuff in a short time. Therefore, there's no reason why this flood couldn't have produced a lot of stuff in a short time. What is that? That's the principle of uniformitarianism, which he says he doesn't believe in. All right, any other thoughts on miracles or how they relate to higher criticism?
Yeah, someone suggested to me that Kant's dichotomy of noumena and phenomena was merely a refinement of Plato's dichotomy between the physical realm and the real, abstract world. Is that silly?
No, it's not silly. I wouldn't say merely, but take the word merely out, and I agree entirely that what you have here, as Whitehead said, the history of Western philosophy is a series of footnotes on Plato. And Kant is a footnote on Plato, but it's very...